You're listening to the Unsiloed Podcast with Greg LeBlanc, brought to you by Alumni.fm. Unsiloed is a series of interdisciplinary conversations that inspire new ways of thinking about our world. So wherever you are today, enjoy today's episode, and here's your host, Greg LeBlanc.
Welcome to Unsiloed. This is Greg LeBlanc, and I'm here with Jan Elster, who is a professor of political science and philosophy at Columbia University, and also the author of many books. I think probably the one that I remember reading when I first came out was Nuts and Bolts for the Social Sciences. That was a real classic, which I've gone back to repeatedly and recommended to many people. Also, we have Alchemies of the Mind, Rationality and the Emotions. We have Sour Grapes. This one is also a classic. We have A Strong Feeling, Addiction, Emotion, and Human Behavior. We have Ulysses Unbound. And most recently, we have Your Turn to History, which starts with France before 1789, beginning of a series of books on the French Revolution. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you. I should correct you. It's not a series of books on the French Revolution. It will cover also America in volume 2 of the trilogy and comparison between France and America in volume 3.
Right. Now, look, you've been doing work in philosophy, political science, economics, rational choice theory for decades, and now you have turned to history, and you're using all of the theories that you've developed over the years to kind of help explain this transformative event, the French Revolution, and also the American Revolution. And historians are oftentimes they have sort of a confusing relationship sometimes with theory, right? Because historians always want to emphasize the particular, while social scientists are always looking for continuities, right, and for general rules. So, do you think that social scientists, you know, when they get into history, can they do history well, or are they necessarily going to abstract from the detail that historians tend to emphasize?
I try to do it well in the sense of paying attention to marker foundations of social movements, but I'm getting beaten over the head by historians who clearly don't particularly like what I'm doing. There's a small symposium on my book online, and most best known of these symposiasts was William Doyle at Oxford, and he clearly didn't like the work. I tried to respond to his criticisms, but I was prepared for this.
Well, I mean, when in business schools, we teach using the case method. In law school, we teach using the case method. And through the case method, we're supposed to be deriving some general principles. And I think that your work is in the tradition of what we might call rational choice, or kind of micro foundations, or methodological individualism. And one of the challenges that you have when you use kind of methodological individualism is it's very hard to talk about institutions doing things or collectivities doing things, right? To say Parliament did this or the Third Estate did that. And I think that one of the puzzles that you're grappling with is, how is it possible to talk about these collectivities as actors? Does rational theory run up against some, rational choice theory run up against some limits in terms of being able to describe these actors?
It's correct that I started out as avid advocate of rational choice theory. Now I deleted the word rational. Key term in my book and my current work is just choice, which can be rational or emotional. So in this book and in the other books that I'm preparing, there's a lot of talk about emotions. Now, methodological individualism, I think, is in principle always the correct approach. In practice, it may be impossible to gather all the data. And the micro data we can gather more often serve as illustrations than as actual evidence. But, you know, I'm doing the best one can. Sometimes you have to treat institutions like a court or a firm or whatever as actors, because we cannot open the black box and see what's actually going on. But I think good science should always be guided by the ideal of micro foundations and always look for evidence. The standard historians' tools of letters, diaries, recordings not written for posterity, and so on. So, but it's very hard. But that's the way one can make progress.
Well, at one point during the book, you talk about the book as being an emotional history, right? Like a history of the emotions that people experience, because you believe that the emotions are a primary force in kind of, well, at least they interact with beliefs, they interact with information, and ultimately lead to action. I mean, have the emotions been understudied? I mean, you described this book as a footnote to de Tocqueville, and de Tocqueville certainly talked about emotions. Have historians ignored emotions? We talk about intellectual history, we talk about economic history, we talk about social history and cultural history. Does it make sense to think about a category called emotional history? Does it make sense to think about emotions as these things which spread kind of like infectious diseases? Right? How should we be thinking about an emotional history?
Well, there's a history of emotions, and then there's emotions to explain other historical events. My focus is on the latter. With respect to France in particular, there's quite a bit of work done on the history of the emotions. For instance, the turn towards sentimentality in France before the French Revolution. But I focus on how emotions like anger or envy or enthusiasm can generate and explain behavior. And there, I think there are many references in passing. Historians say the king was angry or whatever. But to my knowledge, there has been very few attempts to use emotion systematically to explain behavior. So that's what I'm trying to do, especially in volume 2 of the book, where I have a long discussion of a much neglected emotion, namely enthusiasm.
And so you need to have some kind of model for what emotion development, emotion formation, the impact of emotions on beliefs and action, and kind of how emotions diffuse, right? And this has been a big part of your work over the years. So how have things evolved? If you were to talk about the whole rational choice theory over time, as a role of the emotion, certainly in economics, right? We have, every economist is a behavioral economist at this point. And political science has always been kind of copying economics. I remember, you know, when I was at Duke, right, the political scientists all wanted to be economists in some way. Are we seeing sort of a similar diffusion of kind of interest in behavior and emotions diffusing through political science?
I think there are many cases, many individual scholars and maybe some individual departments, but by and large, rational choice still is a high road to tenure in both economics and political science.
Why do you suppose that is? I mean, because rational choice assumes stability of preferences and kind of stability of beliefs. It doesn't really have a model of belief formation other than maybe, I don't know, Bayesian updating. So why is it just that it's easier to model? You know, why is that?
It's a beautiful theory. And also, as you indicated, well, it's not only that it's easier to model, but it holds out the hope of unique predictions, unique sharp predictions. Whereas if you try to look at emotional theory, you don't get that. For instance, if a king tries to oppress his people, will they feel anger, which might counteract the king's intentions, or fear, which will promote the king's intentions? So there's an indeterminacy in much of emotion theory that I think goes against the desire of the rational choice crowd to have sharp, unique predictions.
Right. And I think if you talk to a rational choice person about contemporary politics, they will acknowledge the role of emotions, and they'll talk quite a bit about irrationality of voters and so forth. And so it seems only when you're trying to explain the past that the temptation to ignore them kicks in, right? Is that just sort of, I guess, a belief in the longue durée, where the emotions are just the surface phenomenon and they only loom large in the present and they kind of fade to importance in the past in these models? I've never met a rational choice person who doesn't acknowledge the importance of emotions in contemporary politics.
Well, it used to be the case that the emotions were a residual category, irrationality, with no specific predictive power, more like rust in the machinery of decision. But now, more and more, but not sufficiently, people have come to see that specific emotions have very specific causal antecedents and very specific predictive implications. Not hard, sharp implications, because, as indicated a moment ago, with respect to the anger-fear problem, but nevertheless, some predictive, or let me rather say, retrodictive power. In fact, I think that is probably where my approach differs from standard rational choice theory. They claim to be able to predict, at least in the science fiction world in which they live, whereas I only go for retrodiction, that is, history.
So then is there a divergence between sort of a theory of rational emotions and a theory of emotions that allows for more, I guess, randomness or for more error, I guess? What are the different ways that you can incorporate emotions into a rational choice model?
Well, I don't. I oppose it to a rational choice model. Specifically, in my book, there are a couple of diagrams. There's a rational choice model and there is the emotional choice model. And they are quite different. So, for instance, many emotional choice models generate predictions that violate rationality. For instance, people act against their, well, be careful here because self-interest and rationality are not the same thing, but certainly people act against their rational self-interest under the influence of emotions, as already you pointed out, with respect to vengeance. Revenge often is a pointless, sterile act, but nevertheless would harm the actor, but nevertheless is undertaken under the impulse of very strong emotions.
So is an understanding of the emotions necessary to explain kind of collective action, where collective action wouldn't otherwise make sense under methodological individualism, right? I mean, where groups and crowds and mobs will start to act, where probably, I think it was Gordon Tullock had this model where, you know, it never made any sense for anybody to, you know, participate in a riot because, you know, the best thing to do would be to stay at home and let the other people riot, right?
I know Tullock's work on revolution and I have argued against it in various places. He thinks that people join revolutionary movements in the hope of becoming leaders in a post-revolutionary society. And I think historical examples, numerous historical examples, massively disprove that idea. But it's true that I think emotions, for instance, enthusiasm, can induce a willingness in people to neglect their self-interest. You see that if you study behavior in the American Revolutionary War, which I've discussed, second volume of this trilogy, you'll see many actors, John Adams, George Washington, and many others refer to enthusiasm, both to its indispensability in motivating on self-interest action and in its short-livedness. Emotions have a short half-life and various other features that don't actually form a formal model, but form a complex of features that we can find in very many situations where emotions are at work.
And so do we need to understand this? Do we need an emotional model of the emotions in order to understand kind of leadership as well, right? And how actors can, you know, rally the troops, so to speak, and get groups of people to behave or act in ways that the leaders are hoping to kind of harness?
I wish. I think leadership is one of the hardest things to understand, and I can't claim having understood it. Leadership can have one obvious role, namely in providing information to a set of people who are maybe even be unaware of each other. But the emotional, charismatic aspect of leadership, I find it too hard. It exists. It's very important, but I find it too hard.
Yeah, I mean, look, my training in history was all kind of annal school, and so we dismissed the whole big man, great man, Carlyle school of history as being defective, right? Our belief was that, hey, if Napoleon didn't emerge from Corsica, there would have been some other little general that would have emerged from Brittany who would have done more or less the same thing. And then, you know, when I move over to...
That's what Engels said. Engels said that if Napoleon hadn't existed, someone else would have taken his place.
Yeah.
And he even said that if Marx hadn't existed, someone would have taken his place.
Right. And then when I move over to the business school... Right. I was tempted originally to think the same thing, that organizations have their dynamics and it doesn't really matter who runs the organization. But it's almost refuted every single day when you look at organizations and you see the impact that a good leader can have versus a bad leader when it comes to not only designing the organization, but also, you know, imprinting the culture and getting the people on board to share a vision and so forth. I mean, is there a way to reconcile these things in history, the kind of more structural approach and one that emphasizes the importance of individuals?
Well, what I do is to read good biographies of Philip II or Charles V of Spain, for instance, and see how their very idiosyncratic theories generated behavior. But the problem about studying leadership is that so far as we know, or as I know, you can identify good leaders only by the results. There's no way identifying good leaders ex ante to pick them. That would be good, of course, if we could, but we can't. See all the people who have risen above expectations, like Harry Truman, and others have obviously fallen vastly below expectations.
If only we could do the same thing for leaders that they do in China for like basketball players. You know, grab them at age 8 and figure out who's promising and then run them through the schools, right?
Yeah, but even there, they cheat. I spent some time in China from time to time discussing emergence of leaders in provincial China. And basically they cheat to get judged by outcomes. And then if the road collapses the next day after a visit of inspection, who cares?
So when you're trying to understand something like the French Revolution, I remember when I was working on the topic, you know, a lot of us were focused on the written texts, right? So we would look at the history of the books and try to find causal vectors, right? Where, oh, well, these lawyers were reading Rousseau. So, and then they participated in the assembly, right? So it must have been Rousseau comes up with this idea and then these folks read the books and then they decide to advocate for certain policies. And you argue that, look, that's the tip of the iceberg, right? Most people were illiterate and most people weren't writing, they weren't reading. We don't have any kind of record of what they were thinking and what they were feeling. So how can you do an emotional history of a period like this when the vast majority of the iceberg is underwater, so to speak?
Well, for instance, if you see that behavior, energy, decreases with time, then that's an indication that emotions are at work, because we tend to think, as you mentioned, that preferences are, or ordinary preferences, let's say self-interest, are stable over time. But if people are willing to sacrifice a great deal of material interest and even their lives for a cause, and then after a while, in America around 1777, that willingness subsides, then that's an indication that emotion was at work in the earlier phase. And also, by the way, talking about lawyers use Rousseau to justify decisions taken on other grounds. So when Robespierre cites Rousseau in the National Constitutional Assembly in 1791, it is not because he was inspired by Rousseau, but he knew that this was a good rhetorical trick to get rid of his, or to use against his enemies. I could say more about that, but it would take too long.
Well, one of the things that puzzled me is that in sort of a Coasean world, right, where property rights were stable and well enforced and contracts could be negotiated at low cost, right, we would never have something like a French Revolution, right? All the parties would get together and then say, hey, there's a Pareto improving move that we can all do. And the clergy and the aristocrats would give up some of their rights in exchange for some other benefits. And we wouldn't have these radical and violent punctuations of the smooth process of bargaining. And so if that were the case, there wouldn't be a civil war. There wouldn't be a French Revolution. There wouldn't be an American Revolution. And so I think your work says a lot about why that doesn't happen. So why is it that we need to have some of these revolutions to kind of move things forward? Whether it's the killing of the Jacobin kings, or what is it that's driving this? Why don't we live in this Coasean world? What are the difficulties?
Well, I think people are almost always and everywhere very reluctant to give up their petty, short-term, and partisan interests. And reaching a Pareto optimality, as you say, always has involved some losers. There will be some losers. So unless people are willing to give up, as I said, petty, partisan, short-term interests, they will not be revolution or large social change. And emotions have the power to make them do that.
And presumably they also have the power to slow down that process and get them to resist doing
it. Yes, that's right. Counter-revolutions too are generated by emotions. In fact, in the third volume of my book trilogy that I'm working on currently, I am going to argue, and I've done so already in print several places, that the American Revolution was a counter-revolutionary movement motivated by fear of excessive democracy.
If you were to summarize your thesis about the French Revolution, what exactly were the emotional dynamics that led to the French Revolution taking the path that it took?
Well, it was a combination of anger and stupidity, I guess. Anger, especially in the peasantry, and stupidity in the way the elites reacted to peasant movements. That could be one of a thousand, I'm sure. Nutshell descriptions.
And the American Revolution presumably is not a combination of anger and stupidity in quite the same way?
The English elite was incredibly stupid and ill-informed. And they also, as Anne Smith pointed out in 1776, they had this ridiculous idea of the honor of the nation was more important than the welfare of individual citizens. So they were caught in this quasi-medieval framework of honor, national honor. And they knew nothing about this country 3,000 miles. And as my French hero, Turgot, said in 1750, the American colonies were like fruits that had to drop from the tree when they were ripe. And they did. It was an unsustainable operation.
Maybe we can dig in a little more to the French Revolution. So you mentioned anger played a huge role, but you know, weren't the peasants always angry, right? I mean, weren't they angry during the Fronde? You know, weren't they angry in the Middle Ages? Wasn't injustice sort of a constant in their lives? I mean, every single time they had to make payments to the lords, every single time they had to pay extra for the salt, every time they had to pay a tax for entering a city. I mean, wouldn't this be a source of anger? What is it that jump-started the critical mass of anger that would topple the regime?
It was a constant feature of the Ancien Régime. There's a book by an historian called Jean Nicolas called La Rébellion Française, not revolution, but rebellion, who cataloged 8,625 episodes of violence from 1661 to 1789 for all sorts of reasons, most of them starting in the peasantry, but also some urban rebellions. I think what happened in 1789 was the most important trigger, I think, of the revolution. It was a complex process, was the great fear in the countryside of the spring and summer of 1789, when a rumor developed six different places in France independently that there was a movement out to starve the people by cutting the grain before it was ripe, and various other fantasies, all of which were false, but which were immensely motivating. And that generated attacks on castles, destruction of property records, some killing of lords, which in turn made the French Constituent Assembly abolish feudalism more or less overnight on the night of August 4, 1789. So that is, was, and the more or less at the same time, the very amateurish, stupid counter-revolution of the king's younger brother and his friends in early July 1789 led to the sacking of the principal minister, included the sacking of finance minister Necker, and that generated also popular violence, and Necker had to be reinstated after the fall of the Bastille. So I think the fall of Necker was accrued on, it was dismissed on, I guess, July 9th or something, 1789, was a crucial event because his fall was also one of the triggers of the violence in the countryside, because that proved, thought the peasants, that the elites were not going to reform. They were just going to create anarchy, to recreate the old Richtut regime.
But clearly the formation of the bringing together of the Estates General, right, had an impact, because now there was a forum for people to discuss. Now, some people would say, well, now that you have a forum, you have a marketplace, and people can start exchanging privileges and rights, and this should lead to a smoother transition rather than some more violent transition. But I think the alternative to that is that when you bring these people together, now all of a sudden they can start influencing each other's beliefs, and they can start to act collectively in ways that would disrupt the old regime, right? So is the existence, I mean, most people would argue that the existence of a parliament in England was encouraged to kind of more smoother transitions. But here, the formation of the Estates General led to sort of a greater discontinuity. What accounts for the difference between the French and the English?
Well, I don't want to go into that difference. I think the phenomena are too different to lend themselves to a comparison. But in France, what happened was that the aristocrats were confident, and even the third estate, the commoners, the bourgeois, were pretty confident that the aristocrats, the nobility, would be able to dominate the Estates General because of the deference that almost all third estate members had for the nobility, would just lead the nobles to make the nobles able to dominate them. What then happened was that they met in Versailles on May 5th, 1789, but were stuck for 6 weeks over a trivial question of procedure, namely the verification of the credentials of the deputies. During those 6 weeks, the third estate members were able to get to know each other and trust each other, and also to distrust the nobility. So, moreover, crucial factor in this process was the lower clergy, because in all other estates general, church had made sure to place only bishop as its representatives. But Necker cleverly, we don't know why, packed the delegation of the clergy with parish priests. And then they were much closer to the people. So when the third estate got sacked together, the parish priests soon joined them. And then the whole Estate General, based on three separate orders, broke down and became one assembly where One voted individually and by individual votes, not by votes of the orders. So I think here was a breakdown of deference. And I think I say towards the end of my book that maybe the French Revolution occurred because and when the reaction of the Third Estate to the contempt of the nobility changed from being one of shame to being one of anger. But of course, you need two things. Even if individually many people felt angry, they had to know that they were not alone. So you had to have both, as you might call, the breakdown of adaptive preferences and the breakdown of pluralistic ignorance, where people are unaware of each other's motivations. So these are two crucial psychological.
So it becomes common knowledge that there's this shared anger.
And that process took place, I think, during those 6 weeks.
Yeah, it's amazing how much proximity makes a difference. I read a fascinating history of South Africa, and they described how leaders of the military arm of the ANC met with the secret police leadership, and they went on safari together, and they were in a boat in the swamp and drinking a lot of whiskey. And it was that establishment of trust between the two of them, bonding over discussions about their families and seeing the humanity in each other, that really was the trigger for the peace movement in that country. And without that kind of person-to-person relationship, if they had been isolated from one another and just publishing talking points, they would never have come to that kind of agreement and that realization that they could work together.
Well, something very similar happened in Poland in the spring of 1989 in the negotiations between Solidarity and the communist leadership, where the fact that they negotiated together personally was what made the leaders trust Solidarity, that Solidarity would not take revenge when they came to power. So that's why transition went non-violently. Well, of course, that was stupid of the communist leaders, because what made them believe those promises of non-retribution? Promises were not credible, but the communist leaders believed them. So that's why it happened.
Well, isn't that sort of the obstacle to getting rid of most dictators, right? I mean, if a dictator gives up power, then the new regime is going to kill them or arrest them or confiscate their wealth, right? So I think a lot of people have proposed some paradise island where we could just kind of send all the dictators, right, whenever they're ready to retire. It's the inability to make these credible commitments for mercy that kind of entrench a lot of these regimes, right?
That both in Latin America and Eastern Europe, dictators or autocrats were willing to believe in these essentially empty promises. Because democracy can be defined as by many features, but they include the fact that independent parliaments, independent courts, you cannot promise that the court will not prosecute you, because courts decide that by themselves.
Right. Well, this is a general problem, right? The problem of credible commitment that governments are faced with all the time. Certainly, my research in grad school was really all about sovereign lending in the early modern period. And this was the problem of the French king, right? The French king, although it was absolute monarch, was terribly weak, right? Because he was incapable of making these commitments to repay loans and not confiscate investments and so forth.
He was unable to make himself unable to break his promise.
I think one of the themes that you have in the book, which is really you come back to over and over again, is this idea of the status and how hyper-conscious everyone was of status and the status hierarchy in the Ancien Regime. And of course, look, every aristocratic society had sort of an obsession with status. And you join the noblesse de robe, and then the noblesse d'epée would look down on you. And then even within the nobility, it was like, well, my ancestors were nobles a century before yours. And people would get into disputes over who sat where at what table. And it seemed like no matter who you were and no matter where you were, everyone was hyper-conscious of where they stood in relation to everyone else. How did this both serve as a instigator of the revolution, but also how did it serve as sort of a mechanism for maintaining the regime for as long as it did?
Well, desire for rank or préséance, as they call it, one expression of that desire was, as I mentioned, contempt towards. So one writer has said that the old regime was a cascade of contempts from one rank to the next to the next. So that was, and that generated.
So this was, there was noblesse oblige. It wasn't like, okay, I'm superior, that means that I have to accept more responsibilities.
occasionally individuals felt like that, but there was no social norm to that effect. And I think it was a bit different in England, but I'm not a specialist on that. Now, préséance, so maybe the préséance, the desire for rank, also in some way kept the elite together by providing a shared set of social norms that kept people in line. But I'm more struck by how it led to paralysis and violence, or sometimes just withdrawal, because when the people who recognized that they couldn't be going in first rank went home instead of being in second rank. So it created a great deal of paralysis.
And of course, in the colonies, it was very different, right? So this was not as important a phenomenon, except of course in the South, where racial categories
Virginia,
took this place, right?
Many of these sort of rank issues that people, if they didn't get a seat in the front row in the municipal council or whatever, they just went home instead because they wouldn't sit there to be being insulted. So in Virginia, yes, but even elsewhere, there was quite a bit of rank, but not in that virulent, toxic form, which you find in France.
Right, but these affronts to people's dignity, I mean, this seems to be, in all environments, a motivator or a trigger on rank.
Yes and no. I mean, often people simply adjust to it. So, for instance, in the Soviet Union, people adjusted to the situation, and they were not treated with no dignity whatsoever, but they read the newspapers that in America there was prostitution, racial problems, unemployment, and so on. So they could console themselves with that and then somehow not seek dignity, because to do that would be dangerous. So I think what I just referred to earlier as adaptive preferences, it's just very common that people, instead of trying to confirm or seek their dignity, people, especially if they're isolated from each other, just go along and try to get bread for the next day and read about America in the newspapers.
Well, we see this in a lot of countries, right? So in India, right, it's very hierarchical and your caste is inherited and it more or less dictates your path through life. In China and North Korea and other places, right, the status of your grandparents before the revolution really dictates in many ways your access to political power and economic success. And yet we don't really see the kind of unrest in those countries that you might expect. So why do we see, what triggers the unrest in, I mean, is every situation different? Can we just say, well, there was a spark that was lit in the French countryside and random events and stars congealed and then we had it? Or is it, can we as social scientists predict, right, when these structures will break down?
No, we can't. Nobody predicted, no social scientists essentially predicted the implosion of communism, which is sort of striking testimony to what I said earlier about retrodiction being easier than prediction. Because now, of course, we can see why it had to happen. But China, we don't know anything about what goes on in the Chinese repression apparatus, but some friends tell me that there are 1 or 2 million people full-time employed, just keeping track of people, especially on their activities on the internet. Because the internet has the potential for creating communication and, as you said, common knowledge. But there are, if there's 1 million people or two trying to prevent, that is an obstacle. Of course, that's what rulers have always done, try to prevent subjects from getting together. So even nobles in the old regime couldn't assemble for anything, because it was always seen as a potential plot with, as you mentioned, the history of the Fronde in mind.
Well, I think in China right now, the fear is that these corporations are becoming too powerful, right? The Alibaba is like the Fermier General, right? I mean, they're becoming these entities that have a power of their own, separate from the state, and so they have to be reined in.
For me, it's a black box, and I'm sure there are people who know something about it, but I don't.
Now, one of the things that I've noticed is that almost every single person that I've had on my podcast mentions Aristotle at some point, right? It's almost a requirement. You don't get on the show if you don't mention Aristotle. And you argue that your theory of emotions is rooted ultimately in Aristotle, right? With a little help from Seneca and La Rochefoucauld. So could you kind of tell us, what can we still learn from Aristotle about emotions? And how have you developed this model over time?
Well, that's a big order. Well, Aristotle was the first person who understood that emotions had specific cognitive antecedents. So that the cognitive antecedent, that is a belief generating hate, was not the same as a belief generating anger. He was the first to understand that. And it was also very acute in his insights about what the targets of emotions are, the specific emotions. You see, many social scientists, even today, talk about emotions as if it were one great category. But emotions do their work by virtue of their specificity, that is, by their cognitive antecedents and which action tendencies that are also very specific or different from the for the different emotions. So if you are angry, you want to make the other person suffer. If you hate, then you want the other person to disappear from the face of the earth, as Aristotle said. So they are very different. And it's even really on the micro level that Aristotle is so good. And Seneca anticipates, not just anticipates, but put forward claims about emotions that are still not as well recognized as they should be. For instance, this inherent duality of oppression as generating either anger or fear, and therefore how wise rulers should think long and carefully before they start to engage in oppression, which has a tendency, not always, but often, to backfire. That's what the Englishmen discovered in the 1760s and 1770s. They thought they could scare the Americans by basically trying to destroy Boston. Instead, they created solidarity among the Americans.
And so do you need to have sort of mechanisms of emotional transmission? Can you kind of, right, network theorists spend a lot of time looking into these vectors of transmission?
There are a couple of models of emotional contagion. I think they are a little bit too fragile for empirical research, but they are intellectually interesting. One is that when you experience an emotion, your face changes. When other people see that, they mimic unconsciously your facial expression. And then there's a feedback from facial expression to action. So your action, so that way emotions can spread in the population. Then there is another theory that you may be familiar with as an economist, his colleague, and it's a
information cascade.
Yeah, so that's also hard to get a handle on empirically. So I think the studies of crowds that I've read, the most robust mechanism is simply that people see that there's safety in numbers. There's safety in numbers, and moreover, shame, as La Rochefoucauld said, numbers liberate you from shame. They don't internalize. It's a decency or peacefulness that usually prevent people from being violent. It's undermined by the fact that others behave differently. So they are. But I think the study of emotional contagion or dissemination or whatever, propagation, is very hard. So there are these two models that are nice, abstractly, but how do you actually get the evidence?
Well, I think future historians will find it a whole lot easier because they'll be able to kind of look at all the Facebook data, which will hopefully be preserved, and they'll be able to see this in action in time, right?
And, I think the pandemic also will leave behind itself vast data that can help sort of micro-analysis of why some countries did well and others didn't in fighting the pandemic.
Now, you also referenced de Tocqueville's argument that you're most likely to see a revolution precisely when the oppressive regimes are kind of loosening up or lightening up. And certainly that was true with the Soviet Union, right, where Gorbachev began to engage in some liberalization and that really led to his demise, right? And if you believe de Tocqueville, it's kind of like a handbook for dictators, and it's essentially telling them, whatever you do, don't let your foot off the pedal of oppression, right? Because you might unleash something that you can't control. Would that be a proper guide for the modern?
Well, there's almost a temptation in the face of social unrest to give some concessions to pacify people. And sometimes it works. For instance, Bismarck managed to do that, but it can have the opposite effect, because suppose you are oppressed or exploited along five different dimensions. You just take it for given. It's a fact of life. It's part of the social landscape. That's the way it's always been. It always will be. But then one of these exploitations or oppressions is taken away. And then you ask yourself, well, this can be changed. And that's why measures taken to satisfy population may actually make it more angry. So although population is objectively better off because they are less exploited or oppressed along one dimension, subjectively they feel worse off because, as Stockman says, they feel the other forms of oppression more strongly. And that I think is very common, for instance, to find the very same mechanisms in attitudes first towards blacks and then American, first slaves and then American blacks, that there are in 1809, I think it was the governor of some southern state who complained, who was puzzled that after bettering the conditions of the slaves, they seemed to be more rebellious. He couldn't understand it. And in 1963, Wall Street Journal, I think, had an editorial also saying now that we do so much for the blacks, but they just seem to be getting more rebellious. So that, but sometimes, of course, concessions do work. But the point is, from the leader's point of view, how can I know? How can I know whether oppression will make people afraid or angry? How can I know whether concessions will make people satisfied or dissatisfied? How can you know? And they can't.
Well, I think, you know, among the most important insights that you've included in your work is the idea of credible commitments, right? And I'm wondering, is there a guidebook or a how-to, right? We look at governments all over the place who are struggling with this, right? How do you commit to policies that would encourage investment, that would encourage people to make commitments, right? So if you're Argentina and you're trying to convince your people to repatriate their money and invest locally, right? I mean, no one believes them. No matter what they say, no one is going to believe them when they say that they're going to respect the integrity of these investments, right? So whether it's creating central banks or whether it's creating non-expropriatory tax policies or whether it's trying to encourage people to return back to a country that they fled, countries, they struggle with this. And I think these leaders sincerely wish that they could make these kinds of bargains, but they can't. Do we have a guidebook? Do we have a how-to? Is there a modern prince that we could kind of write and hand to these leaders? What are the key secrets to credible commitments?
Well, I'm sure you read North and Weingast, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And they say that in the abstract, there are two ways of making credible commitments. One, you can build an institution that will prevent you from reneging. So that, for instance, the English king needed to get the permission of Parliament for issuing money. And if he overstepped and didn't repay on time, they just stopped giving him money. So an institution. Or you can do it by precedent, hoping that people will take your current behavior as a reliable predictor for future behavior. And they say that the second method rarely works in institutions. Now, here's a puzzling fact about France. Through most of the Ancien Régime, kings devalued the money by substituting copper for silver or whatever they did. And as a result, there was constant inflation and insecurity and economic inefficiency. Then in 1726, they decided to stop this and have a stable money, which kings had said many times before. After 1726, there were no further devaluations. Because
until the Assignat. Hmm?
Yeah.
Until the revolution.
Yeah. So that's a puzzle because this was too dangerous to touch, as it were, because they understood that once you start that, then there will be devaluations or deflations or whatever, devaluation of the value of the coins in a chain. So in the end, you will lose, not gain. So, but for some reason, precedent worked. Well, now isn't there a couple of economists who wrote a book on how to make credible commitments? Their name might come to me, but there is, of course, all of this goes back to Schelling.
But it seems like in the latter case, you need to have a collective belief that the tiniest deviation is the equivalent to a large deviation, right? It's kind of like when I think it was George Ainsley who talked about quitting smoking, right? You have to somehow convince yourself that if you have one cigarette, then, you know, you're dead, right? If you, like, one cigarette represents the entire lifetime stream of cigarettes, which is an illusion, right? It's drawing a line in the sand and saying that this is a significant boundary. You need this shared collective illusion in order for it to mean something, right? It's a signaling model,
but it's,
to some degree.
When does it work and when doesn't it? For instance, with respect to repaying government bonds, either principal or interest, on time and on the proper terms. It never worked. Every king promised it, and every king broke the promise until one of the very last financial ministers, Calonne, who actually stuck to keeping his promises because he thought that would create confidence that would get, as it were, coins out from the subsoil where people had hoarded it and actually start spending it, which he thought would be some kind of artificial demand, sort of slightly Keynesian. But no, Thomas Schelling was, of course, the originator of the very problem. Although you can see it even earlier, but not formulated theoretically. For instance, in the run-up to the Revolutionary War, there were people who said that, Edmund Burke, for instance, said this, that Americans should let us have the right to intervene and tax, but we will never actually use that right. Well, maybe the current government couldn't do that, but how could they commit that future governments to behave in that way? Especially since one parliament cannot bind future parliaments. So you could say that by exaggerating that both the American and French Revolution were caused by the impotence of omnipotence. French king was impotent because he couldn't make people believe that he would repay the loans on time. And British Parliament was impotent because they couldn't make the Americans believe that they wouldn't tax them whatever they felt like it.
And so do you see a unity in your work between the work you did on things like addiction and sort of these endogenous preferences and your work on the larger kind of social issues? How do you tie together your work on kind of individual choice and these grand historical narratives that you're telling now?
I suppose so, since it's all mine. But as far as I'm concerned, it was just one damn thing after another. Of course, there is some continuity.
So this is a logical progression that your work has gone through.
Well, there is some progression because I started from Marx. I wrote a book on Marx, took my doctoral degree on Marx and figured out how to understand Marx in economics. Then I figured out I had to study economics. And then I had to study the foundation of economics, rational choice theory. And so for a while, I was sort of blinded by the beauty of that theory. But then I started to see so many counterexamples. First of the behavioral revolution kind, first Kahneman, but then also emotions. And that was fueled by my interest in constitution making, which began with my interest in constitution making in Eastern Europe. And also then the two constitution-making processes in America and France at the end of the 18th century. So, and then I was so struck by the importance of emotions. But in between, I did all sorts of other things. So there was no steady progression.
I forgot to mention your other book, Security Against Misrule, which I also have floating around here, which is on constitutions. So I guess final question. I remember when you wrote this book, Nuts and Bolts for the Social Sciences, and then the sequel. And I thought every historian should read this. Right, because most historians lack the toolbox, right? They often don't have sufficient grounding in social science and choice theory. Do you think that the way in which we train historians needs to be more fundamentally grounded in social sciences? I mean, when I was studying history, there was a great deal of emphasis on method and on archival research and a bit of historiography. But in terms of really being rigorous in one's social scientific approaches. And this was something that I think there was more disagreement on.
I think the social sciences in general have two pillars, namely history and psychology. And these two can mutually benefit from each other. I think many historians are, if you read them closely, good historians are sort of implicit theorists. They have their eye open for the telling detail, the counterexample or a hitherto unnoticed connection. And that could be made more explicit. But I think, as I said, I think many historians are really theorists who don't know that they are. They don't generalize very much, but the best historians do generalize. Somebody said that an event isn't important unless it's repeated. So there is something there. And on the other hand, psychology should learn from historians. For instance, historians have struggled with emotion of enthusiasm. There's not a single textbook, handbook, article, website, with minor exceptions, that even mentions the emotion of enthusiasm. although it has it's a well-defined cluster of features, and emotion has immense importance for human behavior. Kant said, and John Adams said, without enthusiasm, nothing great is ever done. You would think that would be something worth studying.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for joining me. France Before 1789, check it out. Of course, all the rest of the books, Sour Grapes, Ulysses Unbound, Strong Feeling, Alchemies of the Mind, and Nuts and Bolts for the Social Sciences. Jan, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Greg.
Thank you for tuning in to the Unsiloed Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review. To listen to other episodes, please visit our website at www.unsiloedpodcast.com.